Hello, everyone, and welcome back to James Cameron's Titanic Scene by Scene. I'm Brittany Butler.
I'm Ethan Brim.
And today we are talking about scene 32, Nearer My God to Thee. A very important scene, huge scene in the movie, memorable scene in the movie, emotional scene in the movie, just a very big, important moment. And I'm so excited to have a very big, important guest, honestly, for Titanic fans and the Titanic community, I think. I had mentioned before that if you are a Titanic fan and your internet algorithm is aware of this, I feel like there is a high chance that this person may have popped up on your feed, on TikTok, on Instagram, wherever, talking about Titanic. Be it a fun fact about the movie or a historical fact or just anything, news updates, whatever. He is there for your Titanic needs. And we are so excited to have him with us today to talk about this scene. Please welcome to the podcast, Raf Avila.
Hello, what is up, guys? It's Raf, the Titanic guy Avila here. What's up?
Literally the Titanic guy. That is your name. That is your handle.
You know what? The only reason I even included that was because when I first went viral, I think people started calling me that in the comments, and me just thinking from an SEO perspective, I'm like, okay, I'll just, if that's what they're calling me, then I guess that's what people will be searching up in case they want to see the video. So I'll just tag that onto the username. And that's how that came to be.
But it's perfect. Just the Titanic guy.
Yeah. That's great.
Can't go wrong. Obviously, we need that guy on this podcast. It's perfect.
I'm so excited to be here.
I know. I'm so excited to have you. Because, like I said, I feel like over the years, I have seen you pop up on my feed so many times to the point where I was like, I got to follow this guy. And then we started the podcast and I was like, we got to eventually have him on. So
the algorithm was forcing the follow. That happens to me with other people as well. It's like, okay, I may as well just click follow.
I had liked so many posts at that point. I was like, I got to follow him. Why aren't I following him?
Yeah.
But yeah, so of course, for anybody who does not know who you are, I mean, that's pretty much your thing. You are the Titanic guy. You are so dedicated to providing the internet with Titanic everything, Titanic trivia, Titanic everything we need. So feel free, introduce yourself, a little bit about yourself, your Titanic origin story, how you got into Titanic, your connection to the James Cameron film, just go ahead, just go off.
Absolutely. Okay, this is, the question that everybody asks me, obviously, online. It's like, how did you even become this Titanic guy? Like, where did that even come from? And I think for a lot of us in the Titanic community, it's sort of a lifelong obsession, mm-hmm. right? Like, for me, I think it began when I was maybe 7 or 8 years old. I remember, and keep in mind, I've always been prone to disasters and things like that. That's just always been my interest. I was a weird kid growing up, I guess. Like, that was always something that piqued my interest. So when I was 7, I believe, I was watching some documentary. It was about this famous ship. There was a shipwreck. And in the documentary, they were doing like this forensic analysis. They were sinking this model and they were seeing what would happen if you kept the watertight doors open and everything. Obviously, that to me was so interesting. I remember asking my dad, I was like, Papi, what is that? And he explained to me, he's like, okay, well, this is a ship called the Titanic. It sank and blah, 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 blah. And I was like, whoa. And I was 7 years old in 1997. Mm. Now, for all of us, we in the Titanic community, 1997 was a very, very big year because that is when James Cameron's Titanic came out in December. So I somehow convinced my parents to take me to watch a movie a couple of months after it came out in theaters. And I watched the movie, and that's really what solidified my obsession, just seeing everything play out like that in such a realistic fashion. I was obsessed. And I remember watching the movie several times in theaters, once with my mom, once with my dad. We went with my grandparents and everything, and I was hooked. So after I watched the movie, then all I would do for fun in elementary school is I would just go to the public library, take out every single book that I could find on the Titanic, familiarize myself with the story of the Titanic, with the ship itself, with the timeline of events, with the passengers, and it just became my life, and it's just always been something that's always been there, you know? Now, the one thing that's different nowadays compared to before is that now people listen to me talk about it. My entire life, it's always like me talking about it. All my friends be like, okay, yeah, Raph is going off about the Titanic again.
Yep.
So, yeah, that was pretty much my childhood. It was just always part of my life. And now if we fast forward a couple of years, this is now April of 2020. And if we go back to April of 2020, we remember that the world was pretty much shut down at that point. So I think for many of us, millennials, I guess, we were sort of discovering TikTok at that time because everybody was bored and, you know, you're trying to figure out what to do. And I actually had downloaded TikTok a couple of months prior, and I had a video, like, I had a video that went semi-viral. It was like 5,000 views. It was literally me and my wife, girlfriend at the time. We were just playing around with like a filter. It went viral, 5,000 views. I'm like, whoa, this is crazy. So that was the first time that I saw sort of the viral potential of the algorithm that TikTok has, which was very different than any of the other social media platforms, mm-hmm. right? So now this is April 2020. And for all of us Titanic nerds, April is a very, very important month. This is Titanic month. It's the anniversary of the sinking. So like many of us in the community, I always would tend to commemorate that by either watching the movie. And since 2016, I believe, I had been tuning into the Titanic Honor and Glory podcast on YouTube. Mm-hmm. So for those of you listening, if you're unaware of Titanic Honor and Glory, they're basically a company. They're creating a game, pretty much rebuilding the Titanic, similar to Titanic Adventure Out of Time. For those of you that played that, you know, the 1995 game.
Yep.
Anyway, they went viral on YouTube because they had a video. It was a three and a half hour video.
The live sinking.
Yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. It was a real time animation. So for a couple of years, what they would do is they would play that animation. They would update it every single year, and they would have other Titanic historians, enthusiasts, experts join in. And it became like a podcast where they would just discuss things that were happening as they were happening. Mm-hmm. So this is now April 14th in the evening, and I was waiting for the podcast, for the live stream to begin. And I think I just had like a glass of wine or something. And then I don't know why, I just got the idea to play around with TikTok. I'm like, seeing as it's the anniversary of, you know, the sinking, maybe I'll just pick an interesting story, a real story, and I'll just make a quick TikTok about that story. So the first thing that popped in my head was the story of Charles Jugan, the drunk baker. So I had the movie playing in the background. So all I did was I got a couple of clips of the actor that plays Charles Jugan, stitched that together, and then I saw that there was a voiceover option. No script or anything. I just went off. I was like, hey, did you know that this person here was actually a real person on the Titanic? This was the baker, and he really did survive. And I just basically explained his story. So I put a couple of captions and everything. It was my first time really putting any sort of effort into a TikTok. Like, I mean, 5 minutes of effort. And then I posted it. And then I checked my phone, and it went from like one view to 10 views to 100 views to 1,000 views to 5,000 to 10,000, all in a matter of minutes. And I was like, whoa, this is crazy. This had never happened to any of my other social media, you know, videos or anything. I was like, oh, this is going viral. This is crazy. So I messaged Sherry, my wife, and then I messaged a couple of friends. I'm like, whoa, this is insane. Anyway, I kind of left my phone. I tuned into the podcast, did my thing. And then when I woke up the next day, that video had nearly 2 million views.
Jeez.
Which was insane. And I'd gone from like 35 followers to nearly 10,000 followers overnight just because the video went super viral.
Insane.
And I was like, whoa, I don't know what happened here. So I had two options really at that point. I was like, this either went viral because people are interested in fun movie facts or interesting movie facts, or it went viral because people are interested in the Titanic. Me, with, you know, being who I was, Titanic is what I'm interested in, right? So I figured, I'm like, okay, I'll just keep on giving more interesting facts about the Titanic. If that doesn't go, then maybe I'll go in a different direction, right? So the next video I made, I think it was talking about Isidore and Ida Strauss. I made another video talking about the dogs on Titanic and talking about John Jacob Astor. Made another video, and each one of those videos just kept on going viral.
Power of Titanic.
It was crazy. Something in the algorithm was like, okay, I guess Titanic is the popular thing and Titanic is getting hit. So I was just getting rewarded with all these different views, and I kept on doubling down. Every single day, I would just post more Titanic content. And that's basically how I amassed like the first 100,000 TikTok followers. And after that, it kind of snowballed, right? It just became my online persona. It was something that is easy for me to talk about because I've been talking about it my whole life, as I'm sure you guys have. So coming up with interesting and new video ideas was very, very easy. I just would think of new passengers or new things to talk about, whether it was the movie or the history or anything. And I just kept on posting about it. And that's how Titanic Guy was born. And then we eventually moved over to YouTube as well, Instagram. And that was all 3 years ago. And here we are today.
Crazy.
That's really cool, man.
So awesome.
Thanks. Yeah, it was very unexpected, but it was it's been fun. It's been really interesting, especially because I didn't realize that there were so many of us out there. I truly thought that I was alone, that I was just like the weird kid, that I was just weirdly obsessed.
Same, but not. But then, you know, when we started this podcast, you know, we've said before on the show, you know, this was like a side podcast to another podcast we did. And I was like, okay, like, you know, I love Titanic. I'm obsessed with Titanic. There was no podcast like this out there. We just did like minimal promotion. And then it's like people just found it for like by searching for Titanic content. And then next thing you know, like, oh my God, like the number of downloads we've reached is like just crazy.
That's amazing. Oh my God.
But it's just the power of Titanic. Like everyone just loves it.
I had no idea. I went to the Pigeon Forge Museum, by the way, if you haven't gone,
I haven't gone to that one, but everyone says to me, dude, it looks amazing.
Ethan's the number one promoter.
Yeah. I'm trying to get free tickets. That's it. Okay. Yeah. But so we went there and like it's packed, right? Like there's a bunch of people there, but it's also like a touristy trap type of town. So I was just like, okay, it's probably just, it's the biggest thing to do in town. It's very obvious. You drive down the street, there's a massive ship on the side of the road.
Yeah,
exactly. Like, okay, what is this thing? So it's like, okay. But then we did this podcast, you know, a few years later. And then, you know, it was, I think, I'm pretty sure it's at its peak. It is easily outperformed our other podcast, which I thought was pretty popular. And we've had like actors and like the showrunner of that show that we talked about on our other podcast. And I had no idea that it was going to be this resonant like it's been, but.
It's because it's so incredibly niche, and there's so many people that are either captivated by the history of the Titanic or the movie, you know. So there's a wide group of people, and it's a very niche topic, and that I think really is sort of like the perfect storm for like viral and just hardcore interest.
And it bridges those gaps better than any other two separate niches ever, because of the movie is so perfect and it's so like representative of the disaster. I think
you got the love story aspect, which appeals to some people like my wife. That's not necessarily what my appeal. My appeal was always like the historical aspects of everything, how much detail James Cameron put into that film, especially if you look at the deleted scenes. Mm-hmm. That was always my thing. So it's like you have all these different people that love the movie and feel something toward the movie for one reason or another. Mm-hmm.
I know, I was going to say that's something that I love about you, is that like you're obviously huge on the history, but you do also love the film and you understand like what makes it great. And, you know, there's a lot of people in the Titanic community who are not that way.
They scoff at it or everything. You know what? Because I truly think it's the perfect story. Like James Cameron, it's the perfect story. Just everything, the symbolism, just even the debate at the very end. I'm sure you'll cover the scene eventually, like, you know, whether Rose dies or not, like,
yes,
it's just perfect the way that everything is tapered off. It truly is just
it's great, and I'm very excited to talk about it. Yes. But funnily enough, I just wanted to share before we start, I had posted a little update on our social media today saying like, oh, we're recording an episode tonight with like a special guest, and no joke, someone replied to our story and said, if you can, you should try to get the Titanic guy to come on the podcast.
Yeah, oh my God. That's so funny. Just wait and see.
So the people want this, Raph. The people want this. So
good. I'm glad to be here. I'm super excited.
Oh man, I'm so excited. Okay. So scene 32, Nearer My God to Thee. This is a scene you had picked as one of your favorites. So that's another reason why I'm very excited to be discussing it with you.
Yes.
And it's a very historically heavy scene, so I'm just very excited to hear any tidbits or anything you will have to share today. So, scene starts on the deck with the band where we had left off in our last scene. They had just stopped the song they were playing previously. They're kind of assessing the situation, and Wallace Hartley decides, like, all right, that's it. So the band starts to disperse. They go their separate ways. They say some little last goodbyes. And I just thought it was interesting listening with headphones. I noticed for the first time that one of them says, "So long, old chap."
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I had never noticed that before, but I was like, wow, I feel like that's like one of those phrases that like you only imagine people might have said. Or yeah. Like,
every time you watch the movie, I swear there's one little thing that you pick up. There's something new.
Yep.
Every single time, even for me.
Yep, I say the same thing every time. Every time. And yes, so Wallace is left there and he begins to play the beginning of Nearer My God to Thee solo. And it's a very emotional moment, obviously. It just sets the tone. It's about to kick off this incredible montage. Each band member returns to him and picks up their part in the song. And I just thought it was interesting as I was reading the screenplay. And apparently there was originally going to be a vocalist in this scene.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I can see where the thinking was, because there are lyrics, obviously, to Nearer My God to Thee. Mm-hmm. But I mean, in the band, I don't believe that there was a vocalist. Like, obviously, no. In the band, there was a pianist, and there were actually two bands, by the way. But mm-hmm. That would have been so weird.
Yeah.
Well, I was reading about the song itself, and reportedly, it was a lot of people believe it was the last song on the SS Valencia, which sank in 1906, like off the coast of Canada or something. I don't really know anything about that ship, but in that one, they were singing it. So maybe there was like some sort of inspiration drawn from that.
There is definitely, I always think it's in A Night to Remember, but I don't think it is. I think it might be a different one where they're all singing it as the ship goes down. Like everyone's singing.
Oh, yeah. I was reading about that too. I can't remember if they were singing it or not, but.
In A Night to Remember, they were playing a different version actually.
Cause there's a lot of, there was a debate about that too, but
and that's the thing, because there are a couple of versions of Nearer My God to Thee, and the version that they landed on is, I mean, there's so many different eyewitness accounts, and people have the way that people remember things were, you know, there were so many different things that people were saying, but James Cameron landed on that, and I guess a lot of historians believe that that was the version of Nearer My God to Thee that Wallace Hartley would have played, because his father, yeah, I believe he was a minister, and just based on the denomination of Christianity that he was at, like that would have been the version that he would have grown up with. So many people believe that that was probably the most accurate version. That's why they went with that version. Mm. Yeah.
I think it's the American version in the film, right? Like, or something like that. There's like a British version or
it was
something.
Like the Lutheran.
Bethany.
It was like the Lutheran or something. It was like a religious denomination. I used to know it, and I'm sure I probably made a video of it at some point. I'm sure that I made a video of it at some point, but it was probably like 2 years ago.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting too, because earlier in the film, they played Orpheus, and it was kind of, and that's kind of like a really chaotic tune, I guess, relatively, especially to this one. And then that's like Greek mythology, and this is very Christian. I mean, it kind of brings us like spirituality into the movie at a important point right before like the terror kind of happens shortly after in the movie. So I liked that. To me, this was incredibly sad montage, and I think like one of the best montages I've ever seen in any movie ever.
Yeah.
Just from start to finish, like usually montage, you kind of, you know, maybe half check out a little bit, but this one you're like super engaged the whole time and like every single bit. And I had to watch it a couple times because just to pick up everything, because, you know, I'm thinking about something that just happened and then something else happens and mm-hmm. I'm like, whoa, wait, what? Yeah. It's incredible.
Dude, the way they were able to tie in all the different side stories as well. Like if you see the band and then you see Captain Smith and you kind of like the emotion that gives off, it's like the audience kind of realizes that this is now a situation that is not going to end happily for most people left at the ship at this point, right? So you see the captain. All you hear is the music. You see it in his face. He's coming to terms with what his fate is going to be. You see the mother and the children down there coming to terms with what their fate is going to be. You see Isidore and Ida Strauss, which I think broke the heart of many, many people. And it broke the heart of many people on TikTok when I told them that they were actually real people. they represented real people. And then there's something beautiful, I think, that James Cameron does, where you see Rose's paintings just floating in the water. And that's when you realize, you're like, wow, Rose's suite is at the very top of the ship. It's on B deck, right? So we're now nearing the very, very end, right? This is now underwater. So it's...
Great point.
Yeah. So there's so many things, like the audience gets taken along for the ride, and it's a sad ride. And that's when kind of everyone realizes, like, the end is near, and this is going to be the fate for many, many people.
And there's no Jack and Rose at all in this
scene.
No, yeah. All, right? Yeah, so. You're absolutely right. There's no Jack and Rose at all. But I think it may be one of the most powerful scenes, despite the fact that your main love interests aren't even in that scene. That's a wonderful point.
Exactly, yeah. It's so incredible.
Something interesting, like piggybacking off of how I said there was originally going to be a vocalist in the scene, like singing these lyrics.
Yeah.
We don't need the lyrics to tell us what's going on. Like, you know what I mean? And so we've kind of goes along with something I had written in my notes was, we have said in the past, James Cameron does very, you know, James Cameron-y things. And sometimes he either, you know, we say he needs to show, not tell, a lot more sometimes. And sometimes what he does is he loves to show us and tell us. He loves to do both, when it's like, maybe do one or the other. But in this scene, this is a whole basically of just like a show, not tell sequence. And I love how he's showing us all right now how well he can do that. Because I think, you know, people come down on him for the dialogue, they come down on him for whatever, but I think this sequence is a real testament to his power as a filmmaker and how he can do something like that, like something very emotionally resonant without hardly a single line of dialogue, except for obviously the Irish mom, and then the screaming and chaos and everything. But yeah, it's definitely a lot of show, not tell here, which I think is awesome, and it makes for an incredibly impactful scene.
And the juxtaposition between the chaos that's almost silent a little bit, you know, not completely silent, but then this like beautiful hymn is really poignant, I think. The lyrics have to do with Jacob's Ladder, which is a biblical story, which is about Jacob, Abraham's grandson, who has a dream about a ladder that goes to heaven. The juxtaposition of that, and then as the ship is going down, and then while the people are, you know, losing, a lot of people are losing their lives, that juxtaposition as well is super poignant, which I really liked. And again, you don't need to say any of that, and it's just, you feel it.
Dude, I literally lost my breath right now because you took the words right out of my mouth. That's exactly what I was going to say. The juxtaposition between, you know, the beautiful him, and then you go back and forth. You see Mr. Andrews just like, he's there. He's just, you know, silent, just accepting his fate. And then you go to the shot as well of everything that's happening up on the boat deck, just chaos. And then you also see Cal and the little girl. That's such a small scene, but even something like that just adds so much more to that emotion. It's just going back and forth with that hymn, tying it all together. It's just, I thought it was beautifully done.
Right, because, you know, you see like a scene with all the chaos, to have this mellow hymn playing over these shots that are so chaotic, you know, it doesn't seem like it should work, but it's perfect. It is the perfect music to accompany this moment. But yeah, I love the way we're just jumping around. But I mean, it's perfect though. I mean,
yeah, you have to, right? It's so much happening.
Yeah, I mean, we'll keep resetting, I guess, as we go, to maybe talk a little bit deeper about each moment. But yes, so the first shot we see after the band is of Captain Smith going into, you know, the flooding wheelhouse, and he just grabs onto the wheel and just like takes it to just hold himself there. You know what I mean? Because it's just, this is a lot to take in, because I think we spoke in our last episode that this is something that he's never experienced before, actually. He's never had to deal with a sinking ship going, you know, down underneath him. So not only is this the first time he's had to experience this, this is how he's going to go out as well. You know, it's just a lot to take in, and you're taking that in, you know, with him in that moment as you're watching this. It's very, very emotional.
The thing is, it's just like, it's unbelievable the emotion that you feel in that moment, because exactly as you were saying, Brittany, it's like, this is the Millionaire's captain, the favorite for the White Star Line, pretty much a perfectly clean sheet on his entire career. Barely nothing of this nature had ever happened in his entire career. It was going to be, you know, his final grand finale. And then in that moment, he realizes this is going completely different. This is now, it must have felt so surreal for him. And there's a lot that can be said about his portrayal in the Cameron film. You know, I'm a big sort of advocate for Captain Smith. And I made a video not too long ago saying that the Captain Smith that we saw in the movie, sort of aloof and everything, that's not probably what the real Captain Smith would have done. By all accounts, he was very much aware. He was very, very proactive in getting all the lifeboats and everything ready. And in fact, his actions that night probably saved many, many, many people, just because he took a lot of safety precautions with getting the lifeboats prepared before he even knew what was happening, right? But in that moment, you realize it's like, this is it. This is the end. He knows exactly what's going to happen, right? And then you see him just coming to terms with that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's a lot. And the next shot is of Mr. Andrews still in the first class smoking room at the fireplace where we last saw him. And he's checking his pocket watch for the correct time and then fixing the dead clock to match. And I loved on the audio commentary, James Cameron said that this is also supposed to draw your attention to the time.
Exactly.
On the clock. And I'm just like, it's just so perfect. Just every little detail. It's just so mm-hmm. good. And so if you remember the time that they said Titanic sank at the beginning of the movie, you yes. will notice that we are very close to the end at this point. He fixes it to be around 2:12 a.m., I think. So we know it's going down around 2:20.
And then the little details, if you notice, you know, the glasses just like sliding off. And I'm sure you've yep. seen the behind the scenes on that one, right? Like the way that they
got the little clear yeah. string.
Yeah.
Yep. And it's like the jelly to make it look like it's tilted.
Yeah. yeah. And I feel almost bad like revealing how they did that, considering, you know, the emotion of the scene. But it's really, really cool, because that was one of the problems that they ran into. I will say a fun fact, though. Victor Garber is from my hometown in Canada, London, Ontario. So that's something that we share.
Oh, wow, cool. yeah.
Random right. little tidbit of information. Sorry. And also, Justin Bieber was born in that city as well. Really, really random. I was not born there in London, Ontario, but that's where I grew up when I moved to Canada. So super random. I know. Huh. Lots of Canadians, surprisingly.
Yeah. For me in this scene, I was kind of putting myself in his shoes. And I was like, it's almost human instinct to want to catch something that's falling off of a shelf. And I'm like, I wonder if the actors ever like,
yeah.
you know, you see something falling and you're just watching it happen in glass or whatever. It's like such a weird thing that goes against our instincts. Just as an aside, it was very strange. But yeah,
it's also interesting that James Cameron, he almost did like this scene is almost identical to how they did it in A Night to Remember. Like mm-hmm. even with the dialogue. Mm-hmm. And I think at one point a couple of years ago, I did like a side by side of A Night to Remember and the 1997 Titanic. And this is one of those scenes where it's like, shot by shot, it's very, very similar. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, but James Cameron's cool. not exactly shy about that. You know, he will say when something is a clear nod or reference to it, I don't remember. But that's cool. You know what I mean? He gets to, you know, bridge those generational films. You know what I mean? Like to be able to take something from a film that was widely considered, you know, like the best Titanic film and putting it into this one. So it like it brings it to the newer generation.
And yeah.
Yeah. It's good. But yeah, there's like so many little things like in that moment with Mr. Andrews, like subtle details about like his character, you know, like him deciding to fix the clock is showing his perfectionism, and you know, until the very end.
Attention to detail. Exactly.
You know, obviously him staying by his life's work in his last moments here, you know, the deep sadness he must be feeling as he, you know, hangs his head, you know, it's just, there's just so much.
I like to think of him as like James Cameron's surrogate in the film. Like that would be the person who I feel like he would relate to the most, maybe.
Really?
Like when he made the movie, like I don't know if he's ever said any who he would pick, but
I think the internet has chosen Brock Lovett as James Cameron's surrogate, but
yeah. That's so funny, yeah, with all of his exploration and everything.
Yep.
But no, that's actually a really good point. Because James, that's exactly how he was when he was making the film. That's why they went, God knows how many million dollars over budget. What was it, like $100 million?
$100 million,
over budget, yeah. Because you just, so much detail.
You have to, when you're writing a screenplay, you have to put yourself into one of the characters at least a little bit more than the others, I think, as a surrogate. And if it's someone like this, it's probably not going to be a main character. I don't think he'd relate to Jack much, maybe, but maybe a little bit. Yeah, definitely Brock, though, too. But as far as the 1912 characters, yeah.
So the next little vignette we get is Isadora and Ida Strauss in bed together. We had mentioned in a previous episode that they were last seen on deck together as like a wave came and took them away.
On a deck, exactly. Yeah. Yes, yes.
But, you know, we said this is a much more emotional, tender depiction, I think, you know.
Yeah, this was a creative liberty that I think really added to the emotion, I think.
And it made for one of the most memorable shots of the film, and it's only about 10 seconds or so, you know, but everyone remembers the old couple on the bed.
Everyone knows it, exactly.
And this was something I had written in my notes, and then I read the annotated screenplay, and they had said the same thing, and I was like, oh, that's awesome. So I had just said that even if the general audience has no idea that these are based on real people, you kind of don't even need to know that in order to feel what's going on here. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? You don't, with no historical knowledge of who these people are, they still make you think of so much.
Everyone can relate. Everyone has parents, grandparents, and you try to picture like what, how would you feel if you saw them doing that? You know, and it's just, it's beautiful to see these two individuals clinging on to each other because they've had a life together for so long. They love each other. And I think James Cameron probably thought the same thing as you, Brittany, because that's why he got rid of that deleted scene where we actually see that interaction between Isadora and Ida Strauss, right? Where they, he refuses to go on the lifeboat and she refuses to leave without him, saying, hey, listen, we've been together for this many years. Where you go, I go, right? And then he got rid of that because it, I mean, for the history nerds, it's great to see in the deleted scenes, but you don't really need it. You don't need to know who they are to appreciate that.
It's weird, but it's almost more powerful to not know. It's weird. But yeah, there's a little blurb in the illustrated screenplay from Cameron that says, audiences don't need to know Titanic history to appreciate the bond between these two people who will not be separated even in death.
Yes.
You know, so that's it right there.
I think that's the moment too, where I think if you had been holding it together up until that point, that's the breaking point for a lot of people.
Yep. I feel like this montage in general, like you will break down at some point in this montage. There will be some image that gets you.
And watching it again too, because you kind of, I mean, it's like a cultural fact that Jack dies. Like everyone knows that, but this is one of those things where like some of these people, you don't remember what happened to every single person that you're seeing here. And you're kind of seeing a lot of it, loose ends get tied up a little bit. So it's maybe a little bit more surprising if you're not as familiar with the film. And all the acting is fantastic too. Yeah. Like every single bit, the couple on the bed, and then, you know, the Brandy boy who with his eyes getting wide was when the water rises. I forget his name.
Later, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, man. just like all the acting, though, was really good in this sequence, I thought.
Yeah, the mom and the kids.
Yeah.
Yep. Wow. That's the next one. And something that I loved about this, because like you said, Ethan, this is like a loose end being tied up. This was this little family that we'd seen a couple times throughout the movie. And then this is their ending that we see. You know, we have spoken ad nauseum about how this movie is pretty much built on setups and payoffs. And, you know, those little times we saw this family were kind of, you know, the setups for this little ending here. And you don't even realize sometimes, like as you're watching the movie, you're just like, oh, like here's a family. But then you get to this part and you're like,
this is their fate. This is what happened to them.
And something that I liked on the cast and crew commentary, Jeanette Goldstein, who plays the Irish mom, she had mentioned that she loves the way that you're just dropped into this moment. because I think in the screenplay it had mentioned like she tucks them in, like you see the whole like beginning of her like putting them to bed and everything, but she likes that you're just dropped into the moment and your brain has to catch up a little bit and think, oh no, like, you know what I mean, like they went back
because the last time we saw them they were there being barred from going up and she was trying to comfort her children, you know. It's like, yeah, once they finished with the first class, then it'll be us. And then you realize, oh.
That didn't happen. Yep. Yeah. So I just said, like, what a payoff. And another just memorable shot that people frequently mention as being one of the saddest scenes in the movie. And it's only, like, 10 seconds of, you know, minor side characters. Of course, she's telling them the bedtime story that is Tir na n'og. She says, you know, they lived together for 300 years in the land of Tir na n'og, land of eternal youth and beauty, which is just, those words are so impactful when you actually listen to them. And who she's telling this story to, these two kids who, mm-hmm. you know, this is the end of their young life, you know, where they're going to live forever with, you know, in eternal youth and beauty. You know, she's saying, telling them this story. And I remember, I think, you know, the internet loves to spin things to make it sound more dramatic. I had always heard people try to say that Tir na n'og was also like a world that you got to by going underwater. But when I looked it up today, I found nothing of the sort about that. So I don't think that is true.
You're just making stuff up.
Or you travel over, I think you travel over water to get there or something. Maybe there's something to do with water, maybe. But
and that's an interesting parallel to the Jacob's Ladder story as well. Because that's, yeah, of course. Because, like, you know, he's envisioning heaven, which is very similar concept as Tir na n'og. Yeah,
like the other world, I think is what they call it.
Mm-hmm. Like an eternity, yeah.
You had mentioned as well, like you see Rose's paintings floating under the water. A very, again, just something, it's a very, very, very short, maybe like 5 seconds. Mm-hmm. But again, it's just one of those things. It's like this beauty of art, like being lost to the sea. I think there was like a line in the screenplay that's like a little corny, but I was like, oh man, it kind of hit when I read it. It was like Monet's water lilies come to life or something that.
Wow. Yeah.
But hey,
that's good though.
It's crazy when you think about it. So let's see. So then we get a brief cut back to Wallace Hartley playing, and he's very, very emotional. Cuts back now to some overhead shots of like over the bridge area and the officers' quarters where they have the collapsible lifeboats or the one that's overturned that they've been trying
Yep.
Every time I see this, I just wrote in my notes that it just looks so incredibly real. There was not one moment where I look at these scenes and think of it as a set.
No.
You know, no matter how many times I've watched the behind the scenes, I know what it went into making all of this, you know what I mean? But every time you watch it in context, especially on the big screen or whatever, you're just in it. And that's why this montage really is like the breaking point, I feel like, for many people, me included sometimes.
It really is, because it's a tipping point for emotions, but it's also the tipping point for the ship. Like, this is now the final plunge, you know?
Yep. It's like the precursor to the final plunge.
Exactly. Like, this is a point of no return. Like, it's,
with this somber song playing, like, it's like, you know, this is the real beginning of the end. Like, this is not ending well. Yeah. It's just so good. All the chaos.
All the details, too, what the actors are doing. And also, I may be kind of getting ahead of myself, but even the placement of the actors, there's one thing, a lot of times, like when I make a video on someone, I don't actually notice that they were placed where they were historically. So in this moment, and I don't know if it's happening in the montage, but it's at around this moment where you see, obviously, Fabrizio and on Collapsible A, when everyone's kind of moving back, you actually end up seeing the actor who plays Sixth Officer Moody. He is there. And when you look at his story, that is where eyewitnesses saw him helping out with the lifeboats. You would never notice him. The only reason I notice him is because when I was reading up on him, eyewitnesses said that he was around there. I went back to the scene and boom, James Cameron places him right there in the TikTok. I was able to film it. I was like, oh my God, I can't believe it. It's nuts.
Wow. Yeah. That's cool. That's really cool.
Go back and watch that scene. You'll see, you'll notice the officer with the, you know, with the insignia and everything. That's Sixth Officer Moody right there.
Wow. That's incredible.
I love these little details. Yeah. So we see Fabrizio. He's like quickly untying Tommy's bloody life jacket so that he can wear it himself. And there's just something about this moment that's just so layered to me. Like, there's just so much to think about that I can't even really think about, but like I feel like just it all just runs through your head right away as you watch it. At least for me, I said it's just so layered and tragic of like how quickly he has to move on from the death of his friend. Because I forgot to mention in the last scene that Fabrizio had kind of, you know, cradled Tommy after he was shot and was, you know, there for him in that moment.
Somebody help me! Yeah,
I know. Oh man, the water rising further and like washing up above Tommy's body, just like, oh yeah. It's just so much.
That's such a good point. You know, the fact that he didn't even have time to mourn, and it's like, okay, now I have to think of myself. Like, it's,
and literally like it's like, well, Tommy's gone, so it's like I have to take this life vest off him and use it for me now. Even like it has his blood on it, it has a bullet hole in it, like, you know, it's just, oh, it's just a lot.
And the thing is, many passengers were probably going through similar emotions, having a part ways with their loved ones, or many stories of those who didn't even, who got lost from, separated from their loved ones on the deck. So it's like, okay, I don't even have time to think about them right now because now the water's coming up. So it's like, I have to worry about myself at this point. And it's, that happened for most of those people at that point. That was their unfortunate reality.
Then we see that shot of the little girl that Cal saved, like peeking over Cal's shoulder, and she's all frazzled and her eyes are wide and she's looking at all of this happening. She's so innocent. Like, she just has such an innocent face, and it almost seems like this is like a moment where, you know, reality is kind of hitting her at such a young age. And there's just something about that brief shot that always gets me too, you know, remembering that one little reminder again, that yes, there were kids on Titanic in extremely intense moments such as this.
They were not immune from danger from real life situations, especially at that point where it really becomes every man for himself. Like, that's, yeah, kind of caught in the crossfires.
Yes. So just more shots of just the chaos surrounding everything. We hear, you know, crew member, that one crew member shouting, I need a knife. You know, just everything. And it's so weird though. Like, there are so many little moments in Titanic that you just like quote. Like the other day, my mom, I gave her some food and then she was like, I need a knife. And then I was like, I need a knife.
That is literally my entire basis for my marriage. Everything that we do is a quote, not only of Titanic, just that's just how my brain operates, everything. But literally, I'm always like, I need a knife. Or like when my daughter was born, I'm like, I can finally say I have a child. I have a, you know what I mean?
Yes.
There's so many different things. Yes. That's actually how me and my brothers grew up. We don't even communicate like normal people. We just communicate in movie quotes.
Yep.
Exactly like that.
That's so great. Yeah, we went in on the I have a child thing in the last scene.
But yeah, it's
so great.
Yeah, it's one of the first things I said. It's like, I have a child. And I haven't even really announced it on my like Titanic guy thing just because I've been so busy. But I was like, I have a child. Maybe that's how I'll announce it. I don't know.
That would be perfect.
Yeah,
my gosh.
Yeah. The thing about that scene, which is amazing too, is if you look at what's happening, like in that shot, obviously that's collapsible A, and collapsible A did stay right side up. And there were several individuals who actually did survive in that lifeboat, but it was basically half swamped. And that was a lifeboat that First Officer Murdoch, you know, it was his last ditch effort to get that lifeboat launched. And I don't know if you've ever watched Ghost of the Abyss, you know, with James Cameron and everything. Mm-hmm. And when you go down to the wreck today, you see that very first davit, that davit in that pulled in position. And that sort of stands as a testament to, you know, First Officer Murdoch's will and just his character trying to do the right thing until the very, very end, trying to save as many people, trying to do his duty. And that's why I think a lot of people have a problem with James Cameron's depiction of First Officer Murdoch, because I think, you know, many of those of your listeners, including myself and everyone, I truly, obviously do not believe that's how he went. I think that he went just as Sixth Officer Moody was, you know, trying his absolute best until the very, very end.
Yeah, that was the episode before our last one. We kind of went in on
the controversy and everything. And
yes.
Oh yeah, it kind of spanned two episodes.
Oh really?
Yeah, yeah.
So let's see. Oh yeah, well, like so with that line, the "I need a knife, I need a knife." When we see Fabrizio, he pulls out that pocket knife to start helping, and I just thought it was interesting as well. If you go back to the poker game at the beginning, there's a pocket knife on the table.
Get out of here. I've never talked about that. I never noticed that. No way.
Yeah. Yep. There's a pocket knife on the table. So it's like they were either, that was one of their prizes maybe that they won along with the ticket, or like, you know what I mean? Like everybody just threw their stuff on the table and like that was one of the things. So I don't know if it had belonged to Fabrizio to begin with, or if it was Olaf or Sven's one of their belongings. And now here was Fabrizio using it in a desperate time that he probably did not think he would need to use this pocket knife for.
I think you just gave me the topic of my next TikTok video there. I never, ever once made that connection. That's amazing.
The ultimate Chekhov's gun is the poker game at the beginning, the knife at the end. That's pretty funny.
But it's crazy, right? Like, who would have thought? Like, here I am winning this ticket onto Titanic. Like, they think it's just this amazing thing that, you know, they're going to America. They happen to take this little pocket knife, you know, with them as one of the little things they take. Who would have thought that I would need to be using this pocket knife in this way on the Titanic that was supposed to take me to this place? You know what I mean? It's crazy.
That's too
good. A little bit of Olaf and Sven in there a little bit at the end on the Titanic.
So we see Cal starting to freak out a little bit. He's like moving away from everything that's going on. He's pushing himself up, trying to get out of the water. You know, this is the way this lifeboat's getting a little overflowed and swamped a little bit. And what else? So we just kind of cut to him briefly. And then, yes, we see Guggenheim sitting in the first class staircase area. And he's sitting there with his manservant. And they're just in disbelief of what is happening. The water is just rising into the first class, which is such a crazy visual.
It is.
Like every time I see that, it's just...
It's like the water is all the way up here. This is almost at the very top. Like it's nuts.
And it's just like, it's a place where water should not be.
Exactly.
You know, it's just a very crazy shot. And not only that, like, it'd be one thing if it was just water in that space, but you have people trying to outrun the water, trying to make it through to get up the staircase or, you know,
just
whatever.
Slipping and sliding, yeah.
It's just so interesting because you have one of the most elegant places arguably ever built on sea with the seawater coming in. You know, it's like not even that is immune to what's about to happen.
No.
Yeah. And you almost put yourself in his shoes for an instance, too. Like it's a reality check for him. But it's also like as a viewer, you're like, wow, like there are people flooding on into the right at the Grand Staircase. So that it's just like when his eyes get wide, you're like, yeah, like this is really happening as he's thinking that, too. So.
And we kind of get it like as a point of view shot from his point of view as well. So so we really are in his position there for a moment as we see this happening in front of our eyes too.
And you got to remember the last thing that he said was like, we're dressed in our best and are prepared to go down as gentlemen. And now he is going down as a gentleman and you're kind of seeing his realization of what that actually means, you know, what his words meant.
Yeah.
Exactly. I always thought that. And I think, what did I write in my notes? I think I said that his reaction is almost a little humorous. Like, and also like knowing James Cameron, like maybe that was a little intentional, like Guggenheim saying that of like, oh no, I'm prepared to go down as a gentleman and dressed in my best. And then it's like, wait a minute, this is real.
Yeah. It almost looks like those like old comic book shots of like Batman, like pow, like, whoo, you know, like the way that his eyes are all like bulging and everything.
And it's like a satire of his type, like that type of person who feels that they're, you know, maybe they're invincible or they're just, you know, above whatever's happening. Yet they're still subject to this tragedy.
Or like it, or maybe like it, you know, it seemed like a good sentiment to say, like a someone of his status.
Yeah, hubris. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah,
some
exactly.
Hubris there, but
But then when he's actually faced in that actual moment, life or death, it's happening now. Yeah. You know, it is just, it's very real, but I feel like, it could play a little bit slightly. But so then we see all the passengers on the boat deck running from all the flooding water as it just gets closer and closer and closer to the band as well. Everybody's screaming. And we get, you know, a final shot of this chaos happening from right behind the band. So like we see it like right over their shoulders. And I love that shot. There's something about that shot. It's so good. It's so perfect. Like you can see them like lowering their violins as they're holding like this final note. And we just see that shot and it's just getting closer and closer. And you just realize that, you know, this is the end now. And I think like they used that shot briefly in like the 2012 re-release trailer. And it was like right after it says, this April or whatever. And it's like that moment, take the journey, like fall in love again and experience Titanic like never before kind of thing. But yeah, that moment just always stuck with me when I think back to watching that trailer and like feeling the hype to like finally be able to see it on the big screen. Cause I never got to see it on the big screen. I saw it when I was 5 in 98 on VHS. It just gives me chills when I think about that now. Cause
and was the Strauss couple also in that trailer?
Yes. Yep.
Perhaps. I remember that for some reason.
Again, it's like a 10-second clip, but they put like 2 seconds of it in this trailer.
Yeah. You can't put it in the original trailer probably because it would kind of
give away. Spoil it, exactly. Moment.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the original trailer was literally like a 5-minute version of the movie, kind of.
That's what they used to do in the 90s. Yeah, everything was just like, where's the movie?
It's crazy. With a lot of like alternate takes that didn't make it into the movie. It's very weird. Like lines that didn't make it into the movie. Hmm. Very weird. But anyway, so of course we make it to the final line of the scene, which is, you know, just such an iconic line. We have Wallace Hartley, they've finished playing, and he says,
gentlemen, it has been a privilege playing with you tonight.
I love the way they let that line sit. You know what I mean? He says it and they just hold on his face there. They hold on his reaction, looking at this water rising. Like we're not looking at the water anymore. We're just looking at him looking at the water. And you hear it, swelling in the background. You hear screaming in the background of this moment before it cuts off and then cuts to like the silence of Captain Smith in the wheelhouse with the windows about to break, but that's the beginning of the next scene.
Yeah.
And I did wonder, I tried looking it up, like, is there any historical background for this being something that Wallace Hartley said, or was this literally something written by Cameron?
In everything that I've read, in, Honesty of Glass or all of that, there doesn't seem to be anything that, you know, people can corroborate it. Even like the fact that people can't even agree on what the final song was, it makes it even harder to try to determine what that final thing would have been. But I think James Cameron took the liberty of having him say that, just the way that they were handling themselves the entire night. It seemed like something that he would say, right? Because the one thing that we need to remember is that the band, they weren't ordered by the captain. The captain technically didn't really have the authority to order the band to do anything. The band members, they were not White Star Line employees. They were contractors, that the White Star Line contracted out to a company for the musicians. Of course, if the captain had ordered them to stop playing or something like that, they wouldn't have overridden him. But there's nothing, he wouldn't have had the technical authority to order them to play. So In everything that I've read, it seemed that it was either a suggestion by the captain or by the purser to say, hey, can you play something? And the musicians themselves, they took it upon themselves to actually go, and they saw that as their duty. And there was also actually a debate on whether they actually should have kept playing, because the whole reasoning for them playing in the first place was to make sure that people didn't panic. But some individuals argue that, well, at this point, people probably should have taken the situation a little bit more seriously. But then on the flip side, many people argue that, think of what the captain and a lot of the crew knew at that point. They knew that there weren't enough lifeboats for everybody. They knew that conclusively. So probably from their point of view, it was more important to keep people calm, given that they knew at some point people would have realized that there weren't enough lifeboats. Right. So having a little bit more composure making sure that people don't panic probably would have been the better course of action to prevent people from, you know, going crazy and then that preventing other lifeboats from being launched and whatnot. But yeah, I think there is nothing that says that Wallace Hartley said that. I think it was totally appropriate to me. I think that was a beautiful end to that scene.
And I think it's crazy then, though, because James Cameron kind of wrote, unintentionally now, a piece of Titanic history almost, because so many people associate that line now, like, with the legend, kind
yeah.
of.
Yeah.
And it's such a quoted line now, too. Like, I was just thinking of all the times I've seen people say that, obviously in reference to the movie, but they're thinking of it as, like, something historical, too.
Mm, totally.
And it's just kind of crazy.
Roth, do you know how many lifeboats didn't get used?
Yeah. So in total, there were 20 lifeboats on Titanic,
okay.
right? There were basically 14 regular size boats, two emergency cutter boats, and four collapsible boats. So collapsibles D and collapsible C, those were launched. But the two boats that you see toward, you know, in those final scenes that they're trying to like bring down, those were collapsible A and collapsible B. So those two boats were never launched. So out of the 20 boats, 18 were successfully launched. Collapsible D, coincidentally, the one that Rose jumps out of, that ends up being, that's collapsible D. That's the last boat that was successfully launched. The other two lifeboats just drifted off, as we see at the end of this scene.
Mm-hmm. And how many people would they have hold speculatively?
The collapsibles, I want to say, I think the cutters held around 40 people and the collapsibles probably held around, I want to say 45 people. Don't quote me on that, but it's somewhere
around there.
Yeah, wow, definitely not the 65 that the full size lifeboats would have held.
Yeah.
But you know, the collapsible B, there were around 40 some men that survived on top of that. So it's that boat ended up saving some very, very important people. Actually, Second Officer Lightoller survived on that overturned collapsible boat. Archibald Gracie. Wow.
The baker was...
Charles Dugan, yeah. You got it. Charles Dugan, the baker, and Jack Thayer, who wasn't featured in the movie, but he is a prominent survivor.
Mm-hmm.
And Harold Bride.
The wireless operator.
Exactly. And if you think about that, it's very important that he survived because he was the only person out of all of the survivors who actually knew that there was... that somebody was on the way.
Right.
There was no way for any other crew or any other passengers, they had no idea whether anybody was coming. They had no clue. They were just going to wait there and for as long as they waited there. For all they knew, they were going to wait there for a full day and then the waves were going to get too intense and they would have just capsized. Nobody knew except Harold Bride.
That's so right. Oh my gosh. Yeah. Wow.
And it was lucky that Harold Bride was on the boat with Second Officer Lightoller, because Second Officer Lightoller, you know, was able to take command, helped those men survive. And
just from a historical standpoint too, people, you know, we have a lot more information that certain people who are important on the ship survived too, so that, you know, we could have references to go off of.
Yeah, that was something we had mentioned when we had talked all about Ismay and everything. How like some of the historians said that he felt like, oh well, I'm president of White Star Line, like I kind of maybe have a duty to survive so that I can, you know, give testimony and be able to, you know, say all of this, you know. So, but that's something I never really thought about before in relation to his story, about how that might have been something part of his thought process, maybe, you know.
Interesting. Yeah, it's super
interesting. Yeah, Collapsible B is interesting. A lot of famous survivors came out of that one. Yeah. Huh. And you know what? It's interesting. Now that we're talking about the movie, there was a deleted scene, which I'm sure you'll cover at some point, and it's during the extended Carpathia sequence.
Mm-hmm.
There's one snippet that was removed, and that was a snippet showing Collapsible B. And you see...
them overturned, yep.
Yep. Charles Lightoller, he's standing up.
I think I saw your TikTok about this. You did a
exactly
TikTok about
that.
It, yeah.
Exactly that. And there's a production... photograph that came out, and that's the one that I showed in that TikTok, where you actually see all of those historical people. You see Harold Bride, you see Charles Dugan, the actors that played all those individuals, Harold Bride, Charles Dugan, Archibald Gracie, and Charles Lightoller. It's just that incredible attention to detail, you know, like even though that scene wasn't used, he put everybody where they were supposed to be on that boat.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And again, we say that's why you gotta respect the movie on some level. You gotta. There's just too much good that James Cameron did in here. You know what I mean? As well. I think that's pretty much it. Well, except for there was just one other thing about the debate about whether or not Nearer My God to Thee was the last song played or not.
Yes.
It's just something that I really liked that the historian said on the commentary. I think it was Don Lynch. He said too many people had reported having heard Nearer My God to Thee that, you know, it must have been played. And then what he had to say was there's a high chance it must have been the last song because what would you play after that?
Yeah, that's a very good point. Yeah.
That was like such a good point when he said that, because he's like if so many people heard it played, it's like that's such a final goodbye kind of song. It's like, what would you play after that?
You're not gonna go back to Orpheus after that, you know what I mean?
No, exactly.
Let's do Orpheus again.
Yeah,
it's definitely. And also, I read somewhere that I don't know how true this is. Wallace Hartley had said he had wanted this song played at his funeral. Or something like that. Like someone had.
I think it was. I think I know what you're talking about, Ethan. I think the historian said, or it was James Cameron actually on the commentary said that Wallace Hartley had written a letter to his sister or someone that said, okay, if I was ever on a sinking ship, I would play Nearer My God to Thee.
Really?
Like, okay, he had said something like that. Wow. I don't know. Do you know anything about that, Raph? That's what James Cameron claims.
I may have read something about that when I made my TikTok about it. I can't tell you conclusively now, but you know, it sounds correct. I mean,
yeah,
that's cool. Yeah,
man. So yeah, I mean, I think that's pretty much it for today. I mean, there's still so much more we could talk about.
Yeah.
You know, we still got a few good scenes left to go here. We're not done yet, but we are getting close. So, you know, maybe we could have you come on another time.
Yeah.
You know that I would be so down. I could talk about every single scene forever and ever and ever. Like, this is what I do for fun, you know? It's great to be able to connect with other people that do it for fun. Yeah.
Just a final thought about the scene real quick. I thought I was going to say too, I thought it was cool how like it kind of from a macro standpoint, it reestablishes this emotional undertone that kind of may get a little bit lost with all the, you know, gun chasing and stuff like that. And so
yeah,
especially is an important beat, I think, right before
the action,
the real,
yeah,
even more chaos happens and like more like terrifying chaos happens. Right. Yeah, it's an important beat, I think.
On the historical commentary, I think they said like it's the calm before the storm, if you could call this calm.
I know.
Exactly. I know. It feels like that too.
It's calm, like relatively speaking, you know, almost, you know, but
yeah.
But yeah. Oh man, but this has been so much fun. I am so excited and just so happy that we were able to get you to come on.
Yeah, this is cool.
It's been a blast.
Thank you so much for reaching out. I was super excited. I definitely would be down to come back on. This has been awesome.
Yeah.
Titanic guy. Everyone, if you're not following him, go follow him. It's awesome. Awesome stuff. And yeah, just thank you so much.
Thank you guys.
All right.
Yeah.
Thank you guys so much for listening. We really appreciate it. Be sure to follow on all of the socials. Send us an email, titanicscenebyscene@gmail.com. Send us a voicemail via the link at the bottom of the show notes. Raph, I'll put all of your links in the description of the episode as well, of course. And yeah, that's about it. Just thank you again so much. It was great speaking with you.
Likewise. And thanks so much for doing this, guys. I feel this is like the podcast that all of us nerds have been like yearning for. This is really amazing.
Thank you. Oh my gosh. Yeah.
It's, thanks, man.
It's been a lot of fun, especially getting into the back end. Like there's just so much to talk about. It's been really great. And having people like you come on to, you know, help us break it down even further, you know, adding that third voice in the mix always makes for just such awesome conversation. So
love it. Happy to be here.
So hopefully we'll see you again soon.
100%.
All right, thank you guys, and we will see you in the next scene.